My next guest on the programme hardly needs any introduction. Stephen Downes's OL Daily is indispensable for any educational technologist. Stephen works for the National Research Council, Institute of Information Technology in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And as he says on his website, he specialises in online learning, content syndication. Stephen goes on to say, I want and visualize and aspire towards a system of society and learning where each person is able to rise to his or her fullest potential without social or financial encumbrance, where they may express themselves fully and without reservations through art, writing, athletics, invention, or even through their avocations or lifestyle. Well, the big problem was, where do we start? What could I ask Stephen? So I started out by asking him where he thought we were in the development of educational technology and where perhaps we would be going.
Well, I think we've pretty much managed to emulate the classroom online. People have been working on that for a long time, and I think they've pretty well got that figured out. We've got these online synchronous delivery tools and the learning management systems and the learning objects and all of that. And so we're doing what we used to do online pretty well, and we're having about that sort of impact. And I think that now people are looking at, well, how can we move beyond that? How can we move beyond traditional academia, university classes and things like that, and reach out to people where they're living, where they're working, in their regular lives, so that they don't have to stop everything that they're doing and go to university and take a class in order to learn something. But I don't think that this is a change that's coming easily. I think it's a change that's coming with an awful lot of kicking and screaming and gnashing of teeth because, the people who offer educational services are used to doing it in a very specific and precise way. And, there are many reasons why they don't want to change that.
Well, I suppose that begs two questions then, doesn't it? If you're saying we're looking to move beyond traditional academia, are you saying that learning is going to go outside the control of traditional academia? Are you saying that traditional academia has got to change to reach outwards to new audiences and new ways of delivering? So I suppose that's three questions in once, really.
Yeah, my faith in traditional academia or in the educational system generally being able to change is not strong. Although there is that, there are signs. I forget what the school district name is in England where they've closed up their schools and have created learning centers. You might recall it off the top of your head, but that is an indication of the direction in which we're going to go, where, our current system is based on bringing people together inside a box and then, well, I don't want to say yelling at them, but talking to them. And I don't think that traditional academia is going to get away from that model, but I think people are, which means, to go back to the first part of your question, more and more we're going to see learning happening outside of traditional schools and especially outside of traditional universities and traditional classes. People ask me, well, how do you make these changes? Because I talk about Web 2.0 and things like that. And they say, well, how do you get teachers to do this? How do you get schools and colleges to adopt Web 2.0 methods? And when's it going to happen? And I think, I tell them, well, I don't try to get teachers to teach using Web 2.0 or anything like that anymore. I don't even focus on that anymore. What I do, if I find myself standing in front of an audience of teachers, I talk to them about how they, teachers, can use this technology to support their own learning rather than to make somebody else learn. I think that has to be the shift in emphasis that we're directing our efforts toward. Instead of trying to have learning as a service that one person performs for another person, thinking of learning instead as something that people provide for themselves using the resources and the connections and the communications that are now available online.
I mean, yes, I largely agree with you. And I've been talking about deschooling society in a few presentations recently. Of course, the reply I tend to get is that it's all very well talking about deschooling, and it's all very well for committed professionals, and it's all very well for those people who've gone through the system, but that the traditional schooling model does provide support for socially disadvantaged people, for people without that tradition. How do you reply to that?
Well, I was reading, and I actually put it in my newsletter the other day, about providing school support services for people of lower income families. And the report said basically that putting money into the school wasn't really helping, that what they really needed to do was to provide after school and out of school activities. I mean, when we're talking about especially lower income students, we need to keep in mind that school is what, only 6 hours out of their day, maybe 7 hours if they go to one of those schools that finishes at 4 p.m. You know, it's a very small part of their day, and school, properly so-called, provides only a small percentage of the resources that they would be using in the course of their everyday lives to learn. You know, people who come from well-off families, they go home, they log onto the family computer, they browse through the family library, there's people there that they can talk to about academic subjects and all of that. These are all the things that people from lower-income families don't have. So the model that provides out-of-school access to these learning resources, out-of-school access to this community, out-of-school access to, you know, even the thing that the article talked about, you know, even the thing like having a big table where you can spread things out on. It's just something that people from families with big tables take for granted. But not every family has a big table that can be used. You know, when I grew up, we had one table in the house. That was the kitchen table. And, you know, when it was time for to get ready for supper, well, you had to pack up and take off because the table was going to be used for something else. And it's that sort of thing. So the point here is that we think of school as though school itself will address these foundational issues, but it becomes, I think, clearer and clearer as time goes by that by providing support outside of school, that's where we're going to address these foundational issues.
And what nature should that support take then? What nature could that support take?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a variety of things. I'm a proponent of things like resource centers, community access projects. We have programs like that here in Canada. We've had for a number of years, just a center, a drop-in center where people can drop in, use the computer, use the internet. I'm also thinking of online supports like educational resources. We've talked in the past about open educational resources. That's where these things come into play. Online support like communities and networks, places where people, either, you know, kids or adults can go in and talk about things that are of interest to them, connect with people who share these interests, share resources, share ideas, work on projects together. So basically, it's you know, a layering of support all the way from the hardware level right through to software, content, community, and interaction.
One thing that sort of interests me is over the summer, I've had a series of students of various ages working for me, and it's been really great. First of all, they're very creative. But secondly, they've all got their own community sites, which they all want to show me. And most of them I've never seen before, because everybody's got Facebook. But it's the variety of community sites and the nature of those different sites. But then one thing that I'm sort of curious about is, in the past, through a schooling agenda, we've had a curriculum which very much has a rationalistic approach to knowledge, but gives us a scaffolding. We build up slowly with that curriculum. Now it appears we're all jumping all over the place, building, taking bits of knowledge from there, bits of knowledge from here, adding a bit there, compromising a bit there. If we've no longer got that traditional building block type curriculum giving us an orderly progression, how do we scaffold our knowledge?
Well, I mean, the presumption here is that knowledge is structured and orderly, and that you can acquire knowledge by building on foundations like that and building on top of it and on top of it and on top of it. But what we might be doing with that kind of structure is, instead of creating foundations, rather directing everybody toward particular knowledge objectives. One of the criticisms, for example, of the school system has been that mathematics education, which is largely regarded as foundational or everybody must have it, has been designed in order to make it easier for university professors who teach mathematics, so that they don't have to go through things like trigonometry and calculus and integral calculus and all of that sort of stuff. And it raises the question, you know, just how foundational is our foundational curriculum? I mean, people talk off the top of their heads about, you know, reading and writing and the mathematics and all of that. But if we sit down and analyze on a point-by-point basis the reading, the writing, and the mathematics that they're actually studying, I think we can certainly raise the question as to how much of this is foundational. You need this in order to need anything else, and how much of it is cultural, we're trying to inculcate a certain cultural background into people, and how much of it is just for the convenience of professors. And, you know, the answer that, because this question has been put to other people before me, and I saw it put to Seymour Papert when he talked in Quebec City, and the answer that he came back with was, if something is foundational, if it is genuinely foundational, then you're going to run across it. If, say, you suppose, let's take trigonometry. If trigonometry is foundational knowledge that you need in order to do other things, then in the course of trying to learn how to do other things, you're going to learn trigonometry. You're going to get back to these foundations sooner or later if they are foundational. You know, and I think that the concern that people have, you know, you're not going to hit these foundational things, is that unless we force them on people, they'll never come up. It would never happen in a child or an adult's life that they would need to look at trigonometry, or that they would need to study Shakespeare or any of these sorts of things.
Last week I was at the Alt-C conference, and a group of us were going to a session, and the room was full, and we said, okay, we'll have our own unconferencing session. It was great. We sat on the grass, around four or five of us, looked at the abstracts and then discussed them. And the big issue which emerged, and it seems to be a concern for a lot of people, is motivation. How we actually motivate learning. And there seems to be a perception, certainly in the UK, that the school system is failing to motivate learning, but some difficulty that we don't really understand how to motivate learning. You've got any ideas? How can we really motivate learning to take place?
Well, let's think about what motivation is. Motivation is convincing people to do something that they don't want to do. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to motivate them, would you? I mean, the big thing about motivation is that the person you apply it to is beginning in an unmotivated state. And I think the question now to ask is, why are these people in an unmotivated state? Why is it that they have utterly no interest in doing the sorts of things that we want them to do? And there's a variety of answers to that. I think that relevance is one of the answers. I think that autonomy, or the determination of their own direction, is another. People find things that they want to do. They find that even children find things that they want to do. We look at what they want to do. They want to do things like video games. They're very motivated to do video games. There's, you know, the video game industry doesn't have a motivation problem. You may notice that. In fact, the big problem with video games is getting them to turn it off, because, you know, they've been at it for 24 hours straight. So when we look at learning and we compare it to video games, you know, we have, on the one hand, learning that is Oh, how do I want to describe it? It's a bunch of it's dry, it's producer driven. It's the student doesn't have any power or control and this sort of thing. You look at video games and you look at especially the way they talk about video games. It reminds me of a phrase from a sentence a television show. A guy called Dylan Hunt in the show Andromeda says, every man is the hero of his own story. You know, in a video game, the student is the hero. The student is the center, the focus. The student does things and things happen. There are consequences. They accomplish things. They do things, especially these games where they're online and they're with other people and they're on quests or whatever, where, they do things and everybody sees that they've done things and they rack up their points and all that. There's nothing in education like that. You go to education, you go to math class, what's the payoff for that? Well, there's nothing there. You're pumping people up to do something where there's no tangible results and not necessarily any results at all. So I think that if we want to address motivation, we need to address it by allowing students more control, by allowing students to pursue things that are of interest to them, by creating environments for them that are interesting and engaging and that give them the capacity to do these things, and then and building in the educational aspect of that on an as-needed basis. When they need something, they'll be all ears and ready and willing and eager to learn about it, but they're not going to be ready, eager, or willing to learn about something when they don't need it.
Well, as you can tell, me and Stephen were pretty wrapped up in this discussion, and it went on for another 15 minutes. I didn't want to edit any of it out, so we decided to split it in two, and we'll give you the second half of this conversation in the next edition. Okay, we're going to take another short break now, and we'll be back with an interview with Seb Schmoller from the Association for Learning Technology.